The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Preppers panic before the shit hits the fan. Most people panic afterwards. I'd rather panic before, and then my panic can be nicely spread out, and then I can, you know, make more calculated, cool-headed decisions as opposed to heading down to the grocery store when there's riots going on.
Hello, everyone. Dr. Chris Martinson here of Peak Prosperity. Very, very special, long overdue show today with the Canadian prepper. Nate and I, we're going to discuss, well, what's going on in the world geopolitically, what's going on domestically, Canada, U.S., where we're going economically, and why you would prepare. But we're going to have to ask the deeper question, which is, which scenario are you preparing for? Mine has shifted. Maybe his has shifted. Maybe all of ours are shifting as life goes on and we learn more and more. Nate, so good to have you on the program finally.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start here. What, how long have you been preparing, and what got you started?
You know, it was probably about 15 years ago. I was an academic. You know, I was a student of psychology. And I think at one point I had realized in my studies that there's so many pitfalls and vulnerabilities to the human psyche. Mm-hmm. We're so susceptible to various forms of persuasion and conformity and normalcy bias and, you know, groupthink, that the various predicaments that were starting to arise around that time post-2008 would likely not be reconciled in a way that was, or at least not without some kind of calamity. So I decided to look at my own situation, and I realized that, man, I am a urbanized person who's very vulnerable. If anything could, anything arose, you know, whether it was some kind of disruption of services, that I didn't have any skills, I didn't have any wherewithal and resources to ride out any sort of emergency, be it short or long term. And so there was this like aha moment, this epiphany that, okay, I realized that there are these problems that are culminating, coming to a head. I'm not prepared to deal with it. In fact, it's almost like an awareness at some point. You realize that, and it kind of really took off when I started to go out into the wilderness a lot more, and I realized just how difficult it would be to survive, you know, because we've been, most people don't realize that they're living in an incubator. And so when you step outside that and you realize how exposed you actually are, usually the motive there is to try to learn the skills that you would need to kind of see you through any type of long-term disruption of services that would arise. So that's where it kind of started for me.
You used one of my favorite words, predicaments. We'll get to that because that's different from a problem. But what an insight, right? A lot of people I know, Nate, have this fantasy. They've never hunted. They've never actually spent more than 10 minutes outside on a weekly basis. But in a crisis, they'll go out and forage and get food. Help bring those people back to reality for us.
Well, I think I'm not sure if it's the consequence of Hollywood programming or what, but we have this idea, I guess, that we're going to rise to the occasion when the time comes. And even preppers often succumb to the kind of consumerist mode of preparedness, where if I just buy all this stuff and put it in a closet, you know, when the time comes, I'll master it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you really do have to get out there and use the stuff and get your hands dirty, which is difficult for some people because, for one, it's time consuming. People are further and further removed from the land, especially as you get into the big urban centers. But yes, survival is very hard. It's very challenging. I mean, I'm living on a homestead now, and I say that in quotes because there's so much technology that goes into it. You know, like, I mean, my geothermal system is one of the most complicated things I've ever seen. I hate looking at it because I know even my solar system is incredibly complicated. So yeah, it's a very harsh world out there beyond the pavement, and people need to be prepared for a disruption in services, essentially electricity. Electricity is really the lifeblood of the system. If that stops, the water stops, the internet stops, communication stops, heat stops, potentially, depending on, you know, what you use as a heat source. So just having an awareness of how frail and truly vulnerable we are in the face of the natural world, and just having an appreciation. And I think this helps to have an appreciation for all of the amenities of modern life. You know, prepping doesn't have to be, I would say that most preppers actually value, you know, these amenities more than people who take them for granted, which is why we seek to try to, you know, conserve, achieve a mode of existence that will be enduring throughout that, because we do appreciate and we value this interaction, the ability to have this communication, you know, in real time, you know, across very large distances. I mean, this is something that is very relatively new to the human experience, and it's because we appreciate it so much that we prepare for it to go away.
Well, let's talk about the psychology of that for a minute, because you started in that psych territory. I backed into that. That's where I had to end up. I'm a data guy, so I just started looking at oil and finances, right, and how money's created and all that stuff. But I couldn't explain, or I couldn't account for how people were making decisions or not. And over time, it's only been reinforced. And so, I had to do this whole tour through psychology, learning about what belief systems are, how people's belief systems are entrenched at the amygdala, that is the emotional layer, then how certain players through advertising/propaganda learned how to push those buttons, and then they weaponized it with like really powerful tools, is my current view of this. And so as you look around, obviously you're in Canada, so as you look around your country, how emotionally manipulated are some people these days, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question, because, I mean, yes, obviously, you know, the whole Albert Bernays kind of model of, you know, try to tap into people's innermost primitive lizard brain type desires is what is driving this whole thing. And the interesting thing about it is that they've conditioned us to fear the wrong things in a lot of ways. It's almost like there's rational fear and there's irrational fear. And we've been conditioned to stigmatize those who have rational fears. Like a rational fear is, hey, you know, like you always talk about, shale oil production is probably peaking. You know, we should probably, you know, be a little bit concerned about this. We should probably be a little bit concerned about this fiat-based bubble that is constantly expanding. You know, we should be concerned about the prospect of thermonuclear war and all these things. But they say, no, don't be worried about that. You know, worry about what so-and-so thinks about you or whatever. So, you know, there's a weird sort of inversion. Like fear is a vital survival instinct. And they've almost, they've really tamed that. And they've weaponized it against people in a lot of ways. So they want us fearing the wrong things. And, you know, there often is a criticism levied against people like myself that we're fearmongers. And then I always think about, okay, well, really the basis of most modern marketing is fear-based in some way, shape, or form. It's like, if you don't buy this and wear this, then you're not going to have friends, you're not going to get the girl, you're not going to get the credentials. So I always say that you have to, in order for you to really take this stuff seriously, there has to be that intrinsic motivation that only stems from a genuine like fear and concern for your well-being. Like it's a survival instinct that they almost need to condition out of people so that they can be more easily controlled. You know what I mean? Like they have to take that self-preservation instinct out of people so the government can kind of step in and take care of business. And so long as that's there, it really is a threat to this global monetary, socio-political, economic paradigm, whatever you want to call it. You know, having the desire to self-preserve and live life by your own terms is antithetical to this conspicuous consumption planned obsolescence model.
Well, I have a theory here, too, which is that a lot of people who are city dwellers, and we know most of them skew progressive liberal for reasons, and we see that in the voting patterns, but they know deep down on some level that they're completely dependent on the system. Like, they have to.
Yeah.
Maybe even on the, maybe even in a cognitive level, they know, like, if the system goes down, they're toast, right? They're not going to eat rats and pigeons very long. You know, it's not going to work out, right? They know that. And I think that it's coded into the human DNA to not be in that position as much as possible, right? You should always know how much food you have stored up for winter if you're in a northern climate, right? You should always be able to take care of yourself and respond to an emergency. So I wonder if there's that, like, that helplessness that sort of part of that doesn't drive some of the psychosis we're seeing, if I could call it that, or poor thinking, or let's say over-focus on really unimportant stuff when you get right down to it, and a complete ignorance about stuff that's actually important, like peak shale oil, right?
Right. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense, because, you know, it becomes in your vested interest to ignore it and to disregard it, because to acknowledge it would be too overwhelming. And yeah, that detachment from there's something there with respect to, you know, being removed from the mechanisms in which you can dictate and control your life and be self-responsible, with that psychosis, neurosis that we're seeing with people. So they have it's like the old Matrix metaphor, you know, because you're so hopelessly dependent on the system, you will fight to the death to defend it, because in your acknowledgement that the system is flawed is in an acknowledgement that you are vulnerable. And so instead we have, as a defense mechanism, we just say, oh, those preppers are crazy, right? Instead of acknowledging, because it is, you know, for a lot of people who live in the beehives in the city, it's a tall order to say you need to start taking real responsibility for yourself. Well, you have to justify and rationalize all the reasons why you shouldn't, because it's a lot of work, you know, it really is. And it's just the reality that it's very challenging, and a lot of people don't have the motivation to kind of see it through. So instead we have this knee-jerk sort of response to prepping, which is really just insurance. And in my opinion, it's holistic health. You know, it's like a good prepper is a good citizen in a lot of ways. If you're a really good prepper, and I'm not just talking about some slob who is, you know, stockpiling stuff. If you're a person who, you know, has good physical, mental, emotional, spiritual health, you're going to be a productive citizen. So that's what people should aspire to.
Well, Nate, this is what I find interesting about this, because I've been preparing for a long time, and I run a scenario in my head, like, if my house burned down, what would I do first? You know, what would I put back in place first? Because I want to find out what's most important for me. And the truth is, I would get my food secured away. And it's something I learned, that as long as I had 3 to 6 months worth of food stored away, and I have much more than that now because I've got animals and grain bins and things. But
yeah,
when I had that, I found that actually my anxiety went down, because there was that little part of my brain back there that didn't, I wasn't even sure I was worried about, but I was worried it was there. As soon as I took that, put that away, cheapest, best stuff I ever, is like the best money you could ever spend. Just a little bit of money on food, you know it's there, and now you're prepared a little bit. I think it's just coded into the human genome, particularly the father gene, which says, I'm responsible here. If my family ends up starving in the dark, my fault, right? But that's how I'm wired. So yeah. I actually think that I find that I, even though we're sometimes they're like, oh, you're the purveyor of that fear-based stuff, I'm like, no, I'm actually removing fear. I'm in the business of taking it away. You'd be surprised.
Well, and it's that kind of chronic background anxiety, like that, as it exists for you, you have an awareness of it. That actually afflicts everybody, but not everybody acknowledges it. So going back to your theory about how there's this, everybody's anxious, everybody kind of has this psychosis because they're not satiated on a fundamental level in terms of providing, you know, the base of the pyramid of hierarchy of needs. Most people, because they lack that, I would say this is totally unconscious, right? Like, to go along with kind of what you're saying here, I believe that anxiety exists for everyone, and then it manifests in these really weird sort of perverse ways that we're seeing today. You know, like, I mean, just go on Twitter or whatever. Everybody knows what we're talking about, right? So people kind of act out in ways because there is this underlying anxiety that manifests in these just, you know, wildly outrageous behaviors, attention-seeking behaviors. And so, I mean, there's a whole potential psychological theory in there somewhere of human motivation, I suppose, societal, you know, civil unrest. But no, I agree with you, man. And it really is about removing the fear and being able to live a more fulfilling lifestyle. Like, I actually think mental health and that equanimity that you achieve through just, you know, living closer to nature is, and not to be all, you know, transcendentalist sounding, but the reality is that the closer you are to that which sustains life seems to keep people focused. And I think especially now going into the age of automation, there's going to be this huge disconnection with people who have no purpose. And so when I go and I do something simple, like all the things that we talk about, these very, you know, complicated subjects, for me to just go and turn my brain off and, you know, work in the garden and pull some weeds, you know, some people don't have that. Mm-hmm. And to have that is medicine in a way.
Yeah, no, it completely is. Nature connection, we're going to learn. This is what I learned during COVID. If God and nature had intended it, that's kind of your starting point. We need sunlight, fresh water, vitamin D, good food, on and on. We need gravity. We're going to find out that we evolved with nature, and being in nature is just it's just part of the deal. And yeah, I don't know how we
there's plenty of reasons. You know, there's plenty of reasons to prep. I mean, I think if we have to justify it to people at this point, maybe it's just Darwinism, you know, at this point. Like, maybe people just, you know, I mean, a lot of people are just, quite frankly, being kept alive by the system, probably. And yep. I don't say that in a way that is, that I mean to be disparaging towards people. It's just a fact that there's probably a lot of people that, should the lights go out, they probably wouldn't be around for too long. And that's nothing I would celebrate. And I would do my best to try to help out my community. But at the end of the day, I mean, the signs are everywhere. I have what I call the 10 C's. And these are things that are kind of culminating and coalescing into catastrophe in the near term. Would you mind if I read those off for you?
Please do.
Yeah, so the 10 C's are all different potential scenarios, not doomsday scenarios, but things that could trigger disruptions. And so you have conflict, which of course is very geopolitical in nature. It could be internal, domestic, or it could be with between nation states. You have commodity scarcity, which you talk about often. You have cyber and cybersecurity and AI threats. So you can kind of merge those into one. Of course, a simple cyber attack could potentially, you know, make the ATM stop or make the power stop or make telecommunications stop. Contagions, as you know full well. You have commerce and economic collapse. You have censorship and coercion. You have civil unrest, citizenship and immigration issues. Coercion, which is one of my main concerns, and climactic shifts induced by ecological mismanagement. So those are my 10 Cs. Now, all of those things are relatively new in the sense that, okay, we didn't really have nuclear weapons before World War II. We didn't have a globalized, you know, fiat-based economy pre-World War II, you know, not in the way that we do now. We didn't have cybersecurity threats. So indeed, these are really unique times. Like there's people who say, well, it's just this, you know, age-old kind of millenarian thing where everybody believes the world is ending within their lifetime. But now we actually have the capability to destroy the planet many times over, whether with bioweapons or through a hyper totalitarian style, you know, panoptical surveillance state. I mean, even the disruptions in the way that we manage ecology could be very consequential. So those are the reasons to prep. So we know the reasons to prep. We know that there's a lot of psychological sticking points. So then the question, I guess, becomes, what do we do in this situation? How do we go about preparedness? And there's a lot of different ways, I guess, we could explore that issue if you want.
Sure. Before we go there, I just want to just build on one of those. You said cyber. Obviously a big concern. Did you see this? Elon just tweeted this out. He said, now I think XAI has a chance of reaching artificial general intelligence, AGI, with Grok 5, which he can see. We haven't seen it. Never thought that before. I have my concerns about this, and they're twofold. The first concern is I feel like I could be George Orwell kinds of prescient by just saying, if this comes true and none of those other Cs hit, within 10 or 20 years, humans are so effing stupid, they don't know how to fix anything anymore, right? Yep. And then if the AI broke, nobody would know how to get the petroleum plant restarted because they don't know the exact piping circuitry of which valves when to get it going again. We'll lose how to do stuff. Like that. That's concern one. But concern two is we don't know what this AGI is going to do when it comes online. Does it go Skynet with intelligence and decide humans are the problem? Does it just write malicious code that we experience as malicious? Is just trying to keep itself alive? Is it just going to do something we never predicted because it's a complex system we don't understand? We're just speeding into it with no guardrails, you know, and seems like this one could get away from us.
Absolutely. And from what I'm hearing, I mean, he is talking about the AGI that they're going to release to the public. But there's a bit of a paradox with that because I was watching a video the other day that was talking about how the best version of OpenAI's GPT-5 is actually not released to the public, which to me, that was always self-evident that you would never release your best model and just make it freely accessible, despite being supposedly open source. You would never do that. So the AI, the super AI, will emerge necessarily in secret. So when Elon says we're going to release, you know, I don't think it would even be a national security threat. So I'm sure maybe there's some gray hair in the White House who knows what's going on, who would say, hey, maybe we shouldn't release this to the public because X, Y, and Z. But what concerns me most is that this will happen and it's going to happen in secret and it's an arms race. And so we're not going to know, they're never going to empower us with the best of the best. But yeah, it's going to dumb us down and there's going to be like an inverse relationship with like survival skills and AI development. It's going to be exactly like that movie, Idiocracy, exact. In fact, I already see it, you know, I've been relying on the AI crutch a lot, and maybe it's just a natural evolution. I mean, we also have to acknowledge that, you know, maybe that's just how things are going to be in the future. You're not going to have to. Maybe it's going to free up more time for us to think about something else. I don't know, but what else is there to think about?
Well, it all kind of steers back to our conversation. I just want to throw that in there because it's part of this scenario set. So, all right, so when we say, well, what do you even do when you start preparing? The first question you have to resolve is, what are you preparing for? What's the scenario that you envision is realistic or probable or likely or catastrophic enough that you're like, I'd better hedge against that. So let's start there. What are you preparing for?
We're preparing in general for disruption in services as a result of the 10 C's, which I think are all really neck and neck. You know, when you think about it, I mean, any of these things can really take center stage in the near future. So what I was saying was it really depends on your starting point. So everybody's going to have a different starting point. Somebody who's living on a very modest budget in the inner city is going to be largely relegated to living out of a backpack. So you start on the level of micro preparedness and emergency go bag building, evacuation plans, things of that nature. A person who is more well-to-do can start at the level of strategic relocation and looking at where is the best place to lay anchor. And that's kind of where I'm at. I initially started out as the urbanite bug out bag prepper. And I think that's good, though, because it's a microcosm of what you need to sustain life. And most people don't know, because you just turn on the tap, water comes out, you turn on the flick the light switch, electricity comes on, you take it for granted. Most people don't know that they need a water filter. So these things are obvious to us, but for most people, they don't know they need a knife. They don't know they need cordage. They don't know they need shelter and something to carry water and boil water in, you know, just simple things. So it's a good starting point for a lot of people.
But the basics, I mean, across all 10 of those C's that you've got, right, there's certain things that just make sense. So for when I was doing all this extensive COVID coverage, I would kind of very cryptically sort of end with a little, hey, plant a garden, right? Because yeah. I knew there were going to be disruptions coming. I have a mission. I want people to practice gardening because then they'll find out, A, they can do it, and B, it's not as easy as they think.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a little more effort. You can grow a few salads, but that's not going to sustain you. You know, you have to learn more than that. Anyway, but with that, I find that, you know, there's no scenario I can think of where I don't want to be able to produce my own food. So it cuts across every scenario I can imagine, from small to catastrophic.
And that should be concerning to people who, you know, I mean, you're a man of sufficient resources, I think, that you could just stockpile 50 years worth of food if you wanted to. So why don't you do that? Well, because you genuinely appreciate the gravity and the extent of the problem, that even if you do have that, you might be removed from it someday. And so to have the skills to be able to do it again, because gardening is hard. It's easy, like you said, but that's a great way to characterize it. It's easy, but it's hard in that, yes, nature does a lot of the work, but at the same time, there's all these inputs and, you know, there's a lot of things that you have to do. Like, life before the 20th century was very difficult. And trying to you know, approximate that lifestyle is going to be problematic for a lot of people. But, you know, for people like yourself to be taking, for like Elon and Mark and, you know, people to be really given this stuff a second look, or Kim.com, or, you know, all these people who are preppers, like hardcore preppers, that should set off some alarm bells in most NPCs' heads, but unfortunately it doesn't. So there's something, the concept I want to share with you, and it's called the sovereign access ratio.
Yes.
And it's the proportion of the wealth that you can access at any given time in custody. And what I was saying was, people who are more well-to-do are having this existential anxiety crisis, if you will, about what they've worked really hard to accumulate. And besides gold and land and whatever you can stockpile, there's not a lot of places to put money. So, you know, obviously that's a good problem to have for a lot of people. But it's just interesting to note that, you know, the more prosperous you become, like peak mm-hmm. prosperity, the more difficult decisions you have to make with respect to the idea that possession really is 9/10 of the law. And so when this grid goes down, and when you can't access the ATMs, you can't access your online banking, you can't access your investments, your 401k, your retirement savings, all those things, you are really in a very difficult predicament where it doesn't matter who you are. You know, what you have is what you got. So, you know, this is why I encourage people, especially those who are of above average means, that you need to take this stuff seriously, because you stand to lose really the most. I mean, the average Joe who lives paycheck to paycheck, it's not to say that they're not going to lose access to services that they've become dependent on, but the surplus is what is so grid tied for most people. So this is why strategic relocation, and also looking at it from the perspective of what is least valuable now will probably be most valuable, you know, in the hereafter, where right now you have in Florida, there's properties that are going for like, you know, $25 million, you know, out on the peninsula or whatever, and gated communities and all this stuff. But that is not, that's going to be the worst place to be, you know? So it's like people now, real estate prime, what's considered prime real estate, is being as close to the spigots of the supply chain as possible. Whereas we need to start thinking kind of in an inverted way about, okay, what if I want to lay anchor on a property, say, you know, where is the best place to do it? Well, there's a lot of things that go into making that decision, but chief among them is security, and being able to be you know, far enough removed from a very densely populated place, but not so far that it's impractical and that you're not going to do it. So, you know, in terms of strategic relocation, I think that's where a big focus could be, and not broadcasting it as well is, you know, something that is going to be very challenging to do, because I think one of my biggest threats is to be quite honest, government coercion and government overreach. And what I fear most, especially living in Canada, of all places, they enacted the Emergency Measures Act, the War Powers Act, which is what it used to be called, over something which was far less important than what could be coming down the road. So if they're willing to do it in that case, what are they willing to do in a real crisis, right? Like, what extents are they willing to go through? We've seen what they did throughout the last few years with the whole COVID thing. Imagine a real crisis, the lengths that they will go to seize control and try to manipulate everything. I think that, you know, people have to be very concerned about that. And that the further you are, I guess, away from the city, as a general rule of thumb, the more likely you are to be left alone. Like out here in the prairie provinces, where it's very sparsely populated, in contrast to places like British Columbia and Vancouver, you know, government, they just don't have the resources to regulate as much, because everybody is so spread out, you know. So the further you can kind of get away from those bureaucratic appendages, the better off you're probably going to be.
Now, if you were going to advise somebody who say had some means, was living in a city, what would you tell them?
Well, I would say that, like yourself, you know, you have a setup going on there, is to first and foremost find a place that has all of the vital resources that you're going to need. So if I was looking for a property, I'd be looking for water, above ground water on the property, access to it. Like, you can have a well, and there can be places where you have several wells even as backups, and maybe there's not above ground water, but water is absolutely essential. I mean, water is, without water, it's like, you know, it's potentially a death sentence. So water security first and foremost, some riparian zone along the shoreline or a riverbank or something is ideal, but that's, you know, finding property like that now is very difficult and very expensive, but it is possible. You also have to look at, like, what is the plant hardiness zone of that region. I mean, you can get a lot of cheap land up in the nether regions of Alaska, but are you going to be able to grow stuff there? You can in a greenhouse, but you know, that's infrastructure that you have to build and you have to have know-how of. Defensibility and security is another big thing. So, you know, just looking at, you know, the various choke points of the property, is it concealed? Is it visible from major roadways? You want to be three turns off a major highway, in my personal opinion. You know, you can get into the more detailed aspects of things. Like a lot of these things is infrastructure you can build out, but essentially you're looking for a place that is secure, that's not too remote that it's impractical and your wife and your family and your kids aren't going to want to live there. Because that's the thing too. I mean, you still want to socialize your children. You don't want them to be, especially if you have kids, you don't want to, you know, deprive them of that experience of being around people. So you have to, these are things that have to be kept in mind. And then there's natural disasters, which are, you know, like where I live, we're on the kind of the fringes of Tornado Alley. So, you know, hailstorms are quite common. Plow winds are quite common. These are all considerations to make. But generally speaking, you know, living far from nuclear power plants, living far from, you know, major military targets. I mean, it should go without saying, this day and age, living very close to, you know, missile silos. We're far enough north that I think the jet stream wouldn't carry the radioactive fallout towards us. But these are just things, you know, if you're really worried about geopolitical instability, then those are going to be the prime targets. And they put them there for a reason, because not many people live there. And they know that, well, if you strike there, that people are going to die, but not many. So, you know, it's an equation. I've actually, with the help of AI, devised a property resilience scale, which weighs all of these variables and tries to assess properties on the basis of their survivability. Land size, you know, land size is one of those things. Like I was talking to your producer before the show, and he was talking about how he can grow 800 pounds of food in his backyard. And, you know, one of the things that I think amazes people is how much food you can actually grow in a small spot. It really is incredible. You can get some chickens, and between the chickens and the small garden, like on a 1 acre piece of land, you can grow just immense amounts of food, you know, if you have the right inputs.
Well, so, I'd like to direct people to, in preparation for this, I was looking at a pretty recent video you put up on your 100x100 food forest.
Right.
Really well-produced video, by the way, and what a great project. But you're going to be able to, that's going to be a lot of food sort of coming, mostly nature taking care of that, right? Because there are trees and bushes and things that are more perennial, and then you take manage some annual squashes and pumpkins and things down there below on an annual basis. But when that thing's cooking, that should be able to provide a lot of food, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be way too much food, you know? But that's the goal, is to have too much. And then, you know, perhaps there could be a little side hustle component to it. And the biggest thing will be keeping the pests away at that point. But yeah, I mean, the amount of food that we're going to get off that, I mean, we had so much squash last year. It was, my kids were sick of spaghetti squash, you know, and we have a greenhouse that is much smaller than that orchard. And that thing produces, you know, tomatoes, you know, all of your above ground crops, like nobody's business. So yeah, you really don't need much, but it is a lot of work, and you want to get those things established, like fruit trees. You know, you got to get those things established, and I wouldn't buy them when they're small. I would try to buy them bigger, the bigger the better, because it's going to take years for them to really start producing. So
yep.
Yeah, the system that I have in place now is, you know, it's a work in progress. And but what amazes me most is really how much the land will provide, so long as the inputs are there and so long as you maintain it and give it a bit of TLC. I mean, it amazes me even after just a year to see the progress and to see once a plant takes root and really starts growing, like it's unstoppable. So it's a nice feeling.
It is. It is. No, I'm in relationship with the soil here. I'm just trying to improve soil. So you probably started with that beautiful you know, prairie soil.
Yeah.
And we started with a really played out sandy loam, which is nice. Not a bad, you know, sketch to begin with, but it needed a lot of work. And so it was going to be 7 years to get it back. We're in year five. I think we're on track. It's doing really well, but it just takes time. So that was the other message I always told people. Like, you know, if you're going to, you can't really like cram for a survival situation, you know?
Right.
You just can't.
Well, and I actually kind of envy that because, you know, we've been lucky here in a sense. I mean, we pay for it with our winters, but to have the good soil that we have. So, you know, you're learning about soil, which I think in the long run from a permaculture perspective is going to benefit you very well because you're learning how soil works and how to develop it and all those things. And, you know, that's an important thing to learn that, you know, we don't have to learn it, so we probably won't, at least not for the near future.
Well, everything I needed to know about it, I got kickstarted by Joel Salatin going down to his farm in Swope, Virginia, right? And he started with a played out piece of land, and it's beautiful now, but he did that without any inputs because, you know, they had the right weather and philosophy and rotating the cows to pigs to chickens and doing all that. I saw, wow, it's really possible. Nature will come back if you just treat her right. She'll do it.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. And so right now what I'm working on is to get an above ground water source on the property. We use in-ground irrigation that comes from a well. And so, you know, if the electricity grows, the well, it's not like some people think, you know, city slickers think a well is like, you know, you go out there with a pump or you fetch buckets. It's not like that anymore. It's technology, and technology can fail. So I'm actually getting a manual style pump installed, and I'm looking into that because that is the biggest Achilles heel in the whole plan is water. So, you know, there's a lot of other considerations, though. I mean, like just pests and fuel and fertilizers and insecticides, you know, herbicides, you know, to do it naturally. Yeah, like I see a lot of food forests and tropic food forests. They start it from the hippy-dippy point of view, which is great. But in terms of practicality, if you don't have all day to pick weeds and tend to it, you kind of need some kind of standardized way of doing it. So that's why I chose to do it a bit more mathematically. Mm-hmm. And over time, I hope that it does evolve into this thing, which is less linear and more natural and more self-directing. But to build a centropic, like a true centropic food forest takes a lot of time. So I'm leveraging the grid right now for everything that it's worth to, you know, to artificially kind of stimulate this process while the means to do so exist.
Exactly.
And I call it the 1-to-100 rule, where it takes an hour to do now what it will take 100 hours to do after a grid down situation. And a lot of that is a consequence of fuel. You know, I think of my tractor, like, you know, Nate Higgins makes the comparison of one barrel of oil is like the work of thousands of people or something like that for their lifetimes. And it's true, like the what I can do with 1 liter of diesel versus not having that. I mean, it would take me days and days to do what 1 liter of diesel can do. And so that's why I'm not of this belief that, you know, you got to do everything raw and natural. I say use as much of the systems that we have in place now to try to get to a point and to try to expedite the process a little bit. I'm not sure if you do you use any of those types of equipment on your
Right now on the property we have an excavator, which we're renting now, but I'm gonna have to buy one. And and then I've got a skid steer with all kinds of implements, and I've got 2 tractors, and then a variety of smaller mechanical things, you know, lawn mowers and little things to tow things. And of course, we just got, and I felt so stupid it took me this long, we finally got a Honda side-by-side. And it's fun because there's this whole community of people who just maintain trails and go out and drink beer and have fun. So that's been fun. But now it's like I own my property.
Is it public land around you?
Well, no, but there's people around here own very big chunks of land.
They let each other drive around each other's land?
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
Well,
and
that's
there's some
cool.
public lands too, but I haven't hit those yet. So I'm just mostly on my land and Mark's land. And together, that's 500-600 acres probably.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, so it's a lot of territory to roam in, and a lot of fun trails. But Joel said, if you don't have a road on it, you don't own it. So we're actually investing diesel right now in pushing roads out onto parts of our land. And now
what
that I can putt-putt down there.
Can you elaborate? What does he mean by that? If you don't have a road, you don't own it.
Because it's like to really work a piece of land, you're going to have to bring equipment there. You're going to have to get to it. Like that if you don't have a road to it, the chance that you're going to take the time to strap on a backpack and go take a day hike and walk to the back of your property is vanishingly small to zero. Because as you know, a farm is a big, giant series of uncompleted projects at all times.
Yeah, 500-600 acres is a lot. I mean, I have 160, and that's almost the majority of my time is spent on 10 acres, I'd say.
Yep.
The rest is kind of just for recreation and driving a quad around.
So, yeah, getting the quad was a game changer for us. So if we could, in the time we have, I'm always checking to make sure if I have stuff wrong. I could be wrong about everything. But as it stands, I can't see a way, what way Trump is pursuing policies, the way everybody's sort of M2 is exploding, which is a monetary measure. Everybody's trying to print. Everybody's growth is low for weird reasons. I think I understand them. Anyway, feels to me like we're going to print our way to oblivion of the currencies at some point. Now, is that next Tuesday? Is it 20 years from? I don't know, but I know it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty comfortable telling people you should spend your money while it has value.
Yeah. Well, and that goes back to that whole sovereign access ratio thing that, you know, I mean, I could give you all the doom and gloom sound bites you might want, but I'm trying to be relatively reserved in my predictions here. But yeah, I sense that something's going to break, and it's going to break in a way because we have this generational exceptionalism right now, which thinks that it can't happen. I mean, even though markets are riding at all-time highs, just wild levels of unjustified overvaluation, it has to pop. It's just a matter of what. But I think what we've seen in the last few years, there needs to be some trigger, some black swan, and then the thing is going to buckle. But until that time, they could probably just keep going up and up and up. So, yeah, I mean, convert dollars into stuff. And it's not financial advice, got to say that. Well, or something that, you know, take a sizable proportion of your wealth and convert it into something tangible. Because if the lights go out and the electricity goes off, or there's some cyber hack and wipes off the ledger or whatever, who knows? It's gone. So... You know, especially seeing as the currency is being, debased all the time. So, I'm not a financial advisor or anything, so I can't really give any real financial advice. There's probably reasons to hold a little bit of cash. There's reasons to have a diversified portfolio, and you know all about that kind of stuff. But for as far as prepping is concerned, yeah, just get stuff, because stuff in a environment where the population is constantly increasing, people are consuming more and more stuff, resources become scarce. As we talked about on my channel when I had you on, all wars are resource wars. And with the oil turning over, you know, we really are in there's a real golden opportunity here to make the investments in commodities, either from a acquisition point of view or just investing in them, because they're things that are always going to be in high demand. And so there's ways to prosper with a preparedness mindset beyond just the post-apocalypse. I mean, even if things you know, stay relatively stable with a few hiccups, there still is a lot of benefit in having this kind of mindset, because you can prosper. I mean, the retail-based, you know, AI bubble is going to burst, and everything else is undervalued by comparison. So it seems to be the prudent thing to do to look at those companies and those commodities that are undervalued and give them a second look. I'm not saying invest in them, but I'm just saying, you know, oil's pretty cheap.
Well, and it's pretty cheap. And Steve Bannon just reported that, according to his sources, Marco Rubio, who's in Israel, is busy getting his ears filled with the idea that maybe regime change in Iran is a good idea. Right. And of course.
Oh, absolutely.
If that results
they're going to do it. Well, we're going to find out on Friday if the snapback sanctions are activated. And if they are, then apparently Iran is not going to comply with the IAEA or something. And then maybe that'll be the catalyst for something to erupt. What are your thoughts on Venezuela? Do you think that is that an oil play?
Yes. We don't. It's not drugs.
Yeah.
We don't send, you know, big chunks of the Navy after a couple of speedboats. That's just not how that works. No, we're making a play. You know, there's pretty sizable amounts of oil, but it's not just that we're making a play for that oil. It's that China's been making huge inroads in Venezuela and making big investments into their Orinoco Belt stuff. And as you, I think you retweeted this, I mean, we're seeing like continued action against Russia's refineries, knocking out significant percentages, like 6, 7, 5, 10%, 15% of their total refining capacity, which is just going to start pinching supply. So, you know, it's not hard, Nate, to think of a universe where oil suddenly spikes in price, which, one thing, our bubble markets are not ready for that moment whatsoever.
It seems like a no-brainer. I mean, all of the metrics point towards more consumption, even if you just factor in the AI data centers. That's going to be consuming so much more energy. So there's so much demand pressure on oil that I can't not see it. I mean, sure, it could probably, I mean, Trump wants to, he says he wants to collapse the price so that they can defeat the Russians, but then that's going to crash the shale market.
Yep.
So, you know, you're going to cut off your nose to spite your face sort of thing. So, I'm almost thinking saying that's almost a bullish sign for me that he said that, because that makes me wonder, like, because I don't think he would say that, because then that would cause a wild sell-off, which we're really not seeing. You know, we're not seeing the big sell-off. We're seeing prices being heavily suppressed, but, you know, I'm sure you have some explanations for why that could be. What are your thoughts on why the price is so subdued right now?
All the commodities have been had a boot on their throat for a while. And so it's just a function of, you look at how the Chicago Mercantile Exchange operates, you look at how the big players come in, and understand that, you know, there's a producer and there's a consumer. So some guy with an oil well, there's a refiner. In between those two now, 99% of all trades that happen are just paper trades. They have nothing to do with the signal, which is this person producing and this person buying. It's whatever. It's the signal of how much money is in the markets. Our markets are so over-liquefied. There is so much cash out there right now. That's why the stock market continues to float up. Good news is good news. Bad news is good news. That's called, hey, somebody printed too much money. And the Fed cuts into that. Everybody listening needs to just be ready for it. The Fed just said, we don't care about your inflation. We're going to make the rich get a little bit richer, and we're going to ask you to subsidize that by what we call inflation, which is actually a theft of the purchasing power of your money so that they can make their wealthy friends wealthier. That's the game right now.
Oh, there's so many reasons to prepare. It's unfortunate, though, because there still are a lot of complacent people around. And, you know, I mean, you can only lead a horse to water. You can't really make it think, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is what we, I'm still motivated to try to bring people the information and to try to show people my progress in this lifestyle, hoping that it will motivate people to take interest. I've tried every which way from Sunday to try to encourage people to get out there and do this life, because, I mean, just by virtue of the fact that there are smart and prosperous people doing what we're doing, that in itself should, you know, set something off in people's brains. But unfortunately, it's not until it almost seems like shock therapy. Like we need more and more crises to motivate people to take these steps. Because even after COVID, there was this brief period where people were really scared. And that's the thing with preparedness. You get the panic out of the way beforehand, so you don't get caught in that flurry of mob mentality and panic buying. So I always say everybody's going to panic. Preppers panic before the shit hits the fan. Most people panic afterwards. Mm-hmm. I'd rather panic before, and then my panic can be nicely spread out, and then I can, you know, make more calculated, cool-headed decisions as opposed to heading down to the grocery store when there's riots going on.
I've maybe you found this too, but I find more people need less convincing than they used to.
Yeah.
Their people have caught the vibe a little and said, you know, maybe being prepared isn't the stupidest thing anymore. I mean, I think more people are on to the idea that something's wrong in this story, and we don't all know what it is exactly, but something's wrong.
Yeah, a lot of it, though, you know, politically speaking, when Trump won, a lot of people put their guards down because, you know, historically, preparedness has been a market that's been cornered by the right. And when Trump got elected, I think a lot of people were sort of lulled back into a sense of complacency. And I was cautioning at the time, these problems are bigger than any POTUS can crack in one term, especially geopolitically. I knew that war was not going to be resolved despite the promises that were being made. And so, unfortunately, now here we are almost, I guess, 3/4 of a year in, and the same problems are really still there. And so my concern is that a lot of these people who've kind of laid their guards down are starting to realize that, you know, nothing has really changed fundamentally just because, you know, the old boss is replaced with the new boss. So you got to remain vigilant, especially until something, you know, fundamentally changes. I would be vigilant, but at the same time, it's important to know that we're, as preppers, we're not, at least myself personally, I'm not looking over my shoulder 24/7. I'm enjoying life. I spend, you know, we enjoy life with our children, living out on the acreage, out on the land, so to speak. And it doesn't have to be a life where you're making concessions. In fact, if anything, it is going to bring you a greater sense of purpose, and you're going to be physically healthier. You're going to be mentally, you know, more of a sound mind, and emotionally as well. Temperament will improve, you know, spiritually. If you're a spiritual person, I'm sure there's benefits in that respect as well. So the idea that preparedness is insurance, but the difference between preparedness and insurance is you'll always have a use for that which you prep. Whereas once you pay that money to an insurance company, the only way you're getting it back is if your house burns down. Whereas, you know, with preparedness, you know, it pays itself off. It pays dividends in other ways.
Well, it does. And being out in nature is important to me. Being outside, being in relationship with the land. I like my animals. I like being in relationship with the soil. But most importantly, you know, Evie and I, we live around a lot of beauty. It's a really beautiful property, and it's getting more beautiful with our actions over time. So the worst thing that happens is we live around a lot of beautiful stuff. You know,
yes,
not the best thing, but in another universe, we still live around all that beauty, but we're resilient. I'll tell you my goal, my stretch goal. I'm trying to get my land to the place where it could, in a pinch, support 50 people.
So you're thinking much bigger than just your own nuclear family.
Yeah, because if things really get in a pinch, you know, your security team is going to be at least 2 guys in 4 different directions, 8 people, 8-hour shifts. You got 24 people just running security for a period of time. The other 26 people are just there to do everything to help see if you can feed 50 people. I mean, it really takes... I could imagine a thing... Nate, where I have one person, their only job is compost. They're on compost all the time. They're just thinking compost. Yeah. Their job is
you
just
need
make
specialization
compost.
If you're going to make life livable after a major disaster, you need some degree of specialization.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have people maybe with like a dual skill set where somebody's a doctor, but their other job is, yeah, you know, I don't know, doing weed control or something.
Yeah,
so,
they're on perennials or
yeah,
they're your animal husbandry or whatever. Yeah, it's
yeah. Well, and this, you know, that could be very daunting for some people to hear that who are just getting into this. But I would just, you know, say to people, start where you where you're at. And I know that's kind of generic advice, but it really, you know, you shouldn't be aspiring to build out if you're just getting into this and you live in the city or you live in the suburbs, you know, hearing people talk about, I'm going to build, you know, a 50 person community out on this, you know, sprawling, acreage, that could be, I don't want to say off-putting, but it's a very intimidating proposition to some people, but eventually, you know, you might get to that place, which is not to say that that's not without its drawbacks. Like, I'm not sure if you've ever watched the TV series Homestead. Did you ever see that? It's by Angel Studios. So it's kind of a,
I haven't seen it yet. It's on my list of things to watch though.
It really does showcase how a very well-to-do prepping community becomes the center of attention post-collapse. So, you know, you're going to have refugees lined up around the block. And the question is, what do you do about that? Well, you got to have some sort of system to deal with it. Fortunately, in the show, this guy had exactly what you're saying. He had a very skilled, privately contracted security team who was in and of itself had problems managing that. So, you know, there's politics involved. There's a lot of things when you really get into the nitty gritty of, okay, how are we going to ride things out? Ideally you would have family, you'd have a plan for extended family. Cause at least, you know, if there's some affinal ties, then that could act as a social cohesion mechanism. Because if there's any sort of politics in that kind of environment thereafter and your security team goes rogue, then you got problems, right? So yeah, there's a lot of things to consider that, I mean, the sky is the limit for rebuilding civilization, you know? This is why I think, you know, when you look at those apocalypse movies, oftentimes the most exciting part is when the shit is hitting in the collapse phase. But The Walking Dead kind of got boring when they started to build out civilization again. Like the closer it started to look like what we have, people lost interest. So, you know, it's much more exciting when you're just barely surviving and scavenging the remnants of the old world, as opposed to having to do makeshift, you know, car trailers and horse and buggies out of old cars that you remove the tops of or whatever. So, yeah, it's but I would just, you know, encourage people, just start where you're at. And honestly, there's a part of me that that also appreciates the fact that if things were to get really bad, there's something to be said about the ability to just survive with what you have on your back and to be able to have that sort of nomadic dexterity that might be required to be more gray man. I mean, that's a big thing, is the gray man is just flying under the radar. I mean, I review a lot of different types of elaborate survival contraptions. And part of the problem has always been balancing, okay, what looks cool and what is the right tool, as opposed to tactical versus the right tool. Because what's tactical often, if it's going to stand out like a sore thumb, it's going to attract unwanted attention.
Our Peak Prosperity Summit was just up in New Hampshire this past weekend, and one of the people there was this gentleman, Gerhard, who lived there, did that, grew up in South Africa. So this is in places where farmers were just getting attacked all the time. And so he had a really interesting approach to that, which was, you know, outer fence, inner fence, you know, red zones. And but then even I hadn't thought this through. They have you have to have gates inside your house. So you have zones inside your house. And these are gates like those metal accordion gates you might see at across the storefront. People will have those so that if somebody even penetrates your house, you still have that last fallback place, you know, where you can then defend from there if necessary. And, you know, it just, listen, they had to face stuff where you're not up against a person breaking into your house. That's one thing. That's bad. When you have 20 people who've cased your place and have decided they're coming in.
Yeah.
Said, you know, that's a whole different scenario. So I hadn't processed what it was like to live in that world. But I could imagine that world, right? People get desperate. You know,
that's what it'll be. Yeah. And delaying and deterring, you know, just having more systems in place, and most people take the path of least resistance. So they're going to probably go for your neighbors first. You know, if you have good terms, if you're on good terms with your neighbors, you help them out. If not, then I guess to every man for himself. But yeah, having those systems, we've done numerous videos on the different layers of defense and just having those detection systems, early warning systems, trying to control the topography in a way that is defensible. And I mean, let's, you know, like there's been plenty of, you know, I'm not sure if you know a lot about military history, but there's plenty of battles that, you know, where the one side was drastically outnumbered, but they were able to utilize a terrain as an advantage. And because you're the defender, you tend to have a, I can't remember what the principle is called. There's a name for it, but it's like a 3-to-1 ratio. So you do have home ground advantage in many respects. And like that situation that you discussed there, you know, they're not just, especially if they're desperate. I mean, it's one thing if they're doing it for, I don't know, sneakers. It's another thing if they're doing it for that which sustains life, food, water. People get far more clever in their machinations. So yeah, you got to be, you know, you got to think about these things, but at the same time, there are solutions. And you know, a lot of it just takes preparation. So
in practice.
Yes.
Yeah. And the other part of that that revealed where I'm deficient is in communications, right? So he said, and I hadn't thought this through. He said, hey, look, here's a picture from an actual home invasion that taken off a security cam. And there's a guy coming through the front door with a backpack with these four antenna. So the guy came with a cell phone jammer. So these people show up. So you can't even call for help, right?
He said, this is in South Africa?
Yeah. But he said, this is turning into SOP. People will show up with, because a lot of people don't have landlines anymore. Even if they did, they could cut those or whatever. They might cut your cable. But, you know, you're gonna cell phone out if you can. So he said, okay, now you're going to have to think about having a plan B. Now what do you do?
And having a mental protocol that you can follow when under extreme amounts of stress so that it's second nature and you're not indecisive as to whether or not, you know, making that decision beforehand and knowing what is going to trigger this response from me. If this happens, I do this. And just, you know, very militarily processing these things. And that does take a lot of practice. And practice is not always appealing to people, but it's incredible. You know, it can be, you know, it can be an experience that, you know, brings the family together. And I think it will really pay off if there was a major emergency, just to have that kind of training that really does simulate the experience. And because, yeah, when everybody thinks they're going to be John Wayne in that situation, but, you know, your adrenaline's going to be, you know, going through the roof. And if you haven't run through that procedure before, you know, then it's going to be very, very challenging. So,
yeah. A lot of people think it's Mad Max and you have to like solve for everything, and that's a tall order. But in between here and there, I think it's very predictable that, you know, when I was growing up, like you could get by on 30,000 a year, and then the Fed started printing, and then it was 50, and then it's 100. And now I would submit that in some cities, if you're not yanking 150 down, you're struggling, right?
Yeah.
the Fed's going to print again, and that cut line is going to go up to 300, right? As it does, you're going to find people falling off the vine down below. And I'm old enough to have lived through the 80s when we had guys would get in vans and leave cities and go out to suburban areas, you know, looking for resources. So that's in my experience set. And I think that very predictable that'll happen again. When people get desperate, they go out looking for stuff, you know. And if that happens, then I think, you know, we're going to have a communication plan with my neighbors. And, you know, I know everybody around because it's going to take a village, I think, to really get through this next period of time.
We live in a very individualistic society, which doesn't value community. In fact, it's had a bad association for the longest time with communism. But you do need to be able to trust your neighbors because you need people to survive. Like you just do. You know, anybody who's a friend is not an enemy. So I think Abe Lincoln said something about that. But, you know, to try to leverage that to the greatest extent possible. And people are assets. We have this twisted view of things because of Hollywood that, you know, everybody you come across after hell breaks loose is going to be a bad guy, and that humans are not resources. You know, humans are resources, and they're, you know, they could be all the difference, just a guy who knows how to build stuff or a guy who knows how to fix stuff, you know, a guy who knows first aid, a medical doctor, you know, somebody who understands soil science or whatever. You know, having people like that in your group is almost as important. So I would say, I guess if a person is not very resourceful right now, for whatever reasons, financially struggling mm-hmm. with inflation, what have you, you know, try to, you know, get around a community of people who maybe have those skills and have those resources.
Well, it seems obvious to me that you know, another easy prediction, we're headed down this technocracy route, right? And, you know, I'm really glad that Elon bought Twitter. It seemed to give us a little bit of free speech for a while, but he's a huge technocracy kind of guy, right? And so the technocracy to me is just the same version of the very old story, which is a very few elite people are going to control everybody else, right? And we've tried this many times in history. Tower of Babel, it never works out. I think that we're headed down that path. I think they're going to try it. And my best guess is they break something they don't even dimly understand, because they don't understand that we don't live in a complicated economy. It's a complex system, but they're going to try and micromanage it anyway. Probably won't work. Best guess, right? So, you know, under those scenarios, to me, if they can turn off for a while, you know, before it breaks, they'll be able to say, hey, Nate, we don't like you. Your money doesn't work anymore. Or we're taking half of it, or it only works within 5 kilometers of your house, or whatever they say, you know?
Yeah.
I refuse to live under those circumstances. So if they do that to me, I'll say, okay, well, I'm still going to grow all my food. I got water and I'm living in beauty, you know, and I'm good to go. It's just, to me, it's freedom. It's sort of like there's the people who want to live under the collectivist, communist, socialist rule. And there are people who believe in freedom and liberty and individual, that prosperity comes from people like you taking risks and building things, right? That's where prosperity actually comes from.
Yeah, and, you know, we have to be very careful, too, with, because I'm not sure, are you familiar with the, what was it called? The, is it the 100 Flowers program that they had in China during the Maoist era, where the Summer of Flowers, that's what it was, where they encouraged people to speak freely about their innermost thoughts about the government and all these things. So I'm very worried about honey traps at this point in time. And I mean, the technocracy and techno-fascism, whatever you want to call it, the Whitney Webb type view, it's not always going to just be given to you on a silver platter. You know, you're going to have to decipher it. And I'm very concerned with X, to be brutally honest, that it's a mechanism which is trying to encourage people to express themselves maybe a little bit too much. if you really want to, you know, understand people, how they tick, they have to feel liberated to speak their minds. Mm-hmm. And so you know, potentially that could be weaponized against us in the future. And it's so micromanaged now in terms of finally tuning that algorithm and understanding our psyche. And that it just gets, every time we use the programs, it becomes more dialed into who we are, what we want, all these things. So what you're saying is, you know, eventually it's going to reach a point where it's going to be that turnkey totalitarianism where at the flip of a switch, you know, you can be, they're going to say, hey, your money, you know, they're going to cut you off from whatever sort of credit system. So you're going to be relegated to bartering or using your own more archaic medium of exchange, like gold or silver or whatever, which if you have that stuff, you'll be fine. But for most people, if you don't comply, and we've seen that through COVID, if you don't comply, then you get cut off. You lose your job. Some people had their bank accounts frozen here in Canada because they protested the whole thing. So yeah, it's a brave new world that we're entering. And it's one of my biggest concerns right now is how that's going to be abused. And the problem is it's one of the hardest things to escape. Like when we're talking about, I've always thought that, you know, the Mad Max world is easier to survive than this sort of hybrid, it's cyberpunk dystopia, because at least with Mad Max, you know what a threat is and what it isn't. There's either law or there isn't law. But when there's this kind of in between where there's lawfare and there's, you know, that's when, you know, it gets very hard to navigate that environment.
One of the things I struggle with is what we're experiencing just organic, meaning late stage empire, people lose the plot line. It's happened over and over again. Welcome to the long-term large cycles of humanity. Or is it intentional? Because sometimes I can rotate the Rubik's Cube, look at a different face and say, hey, Nate, it looks to me like we're under attack, right? Somebody decided to open the border. Somebody decided to drain the SPR. Somebody decided to overprint money and just like push till that thing breaks. Somebody decided to run programs where they have such power, they were able to get transgender ideology into kindergartens, right? Normally curricula changes take a long time. This just sort of snuck in. You're learning about how we have to eat bugs again at the curriculum level in the schools. And so when I look at that, I'm like, it doesn't feel organic anymore. Like there's some pressures pushing. And of course you had the WEF saying, you're going to own nothing and be happy about it. We promise. And you're going to eat no meat. And Western values will have been tested to the breaking point. They told us these things. And so I'm this guy. If somebody says they're going to do something and it happens, maybe they did it, you know? So if we're under attack, I think it becomes more important. And I'm having more conversations like this with people like you, but lots of other people who I would have considered more normal, resistant to that. Anyway, they're starting to see the patterns for what they are and go, hey, wait a minute. If we're under attack and they're serious about this, maybe A, we should do something about it, or maybe I should be prepared for this in some way that I haven't been yet.
It's hard to believe sometimes that they would have such a long view of things, but then you have to wonder, you know, just the way things are going. It seems like something is guiding this that doesn't quite meet the eye, you know? Like, it seems like maybe there is a you know, I'm not of the belief that there's a view, and I'm sure you've heard it, that well, they're bringing in immigrants because they want to collapse the United States. And it's like, and then it goes off into, well, is it a communist ploy? Is it, you know, various cabals that share ethnic similarities, if you know what I mean? And, you know, all I can do at this point in time, because there's so many conflicting points of view, all we can see is that what we've seen in COVID is just a taste of what could potentially be coming. That's all I know, is that abuse of power was just a small fraction of what it could have been and what it could be if things get worse. And all those horror stories we hear throughout history, that could easily be replicated, because people have this idea that we're different now. We have that generational exceptionalism. Well, we're more ethically evolved now than we were and throughout the concentration camps and all that stuff. But we aren't, right? You know, we're the same fundamentally biologically flawed individuals who will as studies show in conformity and social obedience experiments, they all show that the majority of people, 90% in those Milgram experiments, would essentially shock somebody to death if they felt that the responsibility was being deflected onto someone else. And that hasn't changed. So, I mean, you got to prepare for that reality, right? No matter, it doesn't matter if you think it's this group or that group, how are you going to prepare for it? And this is why when I watch all the outrage porn, whether it's Candace Owens or, you know, Shapiro or Tim Pool, and nothing against these people personally, but when I hear it, the missing part of the puzzle is, what are you going to do about it? Because you know this train is coming. So there's so few people like yourself who are actually saying, hey, okay, we see the problem and here's a solution. Not just get really mad and get some pitchforks and go out into the street and, you know, that's not going to, what is that going to do for you and your family? So I'm just glad that people like yourself are starting to, and not starting because you've done this for a long time, but just in general, there's a general movement towards, okay, it's fine to be identifying problems, but we also need to do something about it.
Exactly. So from COVID to Charlie Kirk, let me connect these dots, because COVID, I think, broke a lot of brains, and it was just constant fear programming, right? And now we look back and, you know, most people can identify it had a 99.95% survival rate. Not that big a deal. If you were morbidly obese and over 70, maybe, right? But for everybody else, it was kind of a nothing burger. But still, we reacted, you know, we trampled rights, broke people's brains, all that. And then I watched this strange thing happen with Trump derangement syndrome, right? Where somebody like Sam Harris, otherwise a very smart, his whole brand is being erudite. But in this one area, he just breaks down, like just like gets crushed, right? I don't know if it's recoverable, second question. But we get to Charlie Kirk, and suddenly I find out that there are people who are celebrating, actively celebrating the idea that somebody should be murdered for their ideas, right? And they didn't even necessarily even know what his ideas were. They would program to believe they were a misogynistic, racist, whatever, even though good luck finding a quote that supports that from him directly, right? It didn't matter. But so when we look at that, and I think vaccines are breaking this apart too, we have these people who believe that we should defer to experts. They tell us right from wrong, but we have to do whatever they say. So that includes, I should be able to mandate what goes in your body, right? As if I owned you, you were my slave, right? As Jeff Childers put it. And then there are other people like, no, this is kind of a moral issue. And you have the right to define for yourself how to live. This is an incompatible worldview. And I feel like there are active forces pushing this, Nate, to create the conditions, which I now understand how civil wars get started. Because these are fundamentally incompatible worldviews. And there's no middle ground, right? You know, how do you negotiate a middle ground with some? They could tell me all day long, listen, Chris, I think your daughters ought to, you know, consider chopping off their breast tissue because, you know, that would be gender affirming. And I'd be over here going, well, no, I'm pretty sure the answer to that is no. There's no middle ground. Like, you know, I don't know how we reconcile this anymore. Because they're sure I'm wrong, and I'm sure they're wrong. And that's how this all gets started.
And I think we need to really zoom out, because a lot of those outrageous propositions that were brought with the so-called woke movement were, I think, intentional to trigger people. Like, I mean, some of the things were so over the top and outrageous, you almost have to ask, was it to get people riled up on the other side? Was it to really polarize people? Because they knew there was going to be pushback. And I knew there'd be an inversion at some point, which is what we're seeing now. The tables turn, and, you know, there's that whole cycle of ideological subversion that happens over a generation or so. There was a time when, you know, the people were protesting, and there was a righteous element to leftist protest. It was largely anti-war, you know, pro-working class, that sort of thing. And then it kind of became more elaborate and weaponized, I think, because what they're trying to do is they're really trying to, and I would caution a lot of people against this whole Charlie Kirk thing. To me, I'm not going to get into what I who I think did it. I mean, I don't know. It seems like that's going to be a rabbit hole, endless JFK type rabbit hole to go down. But I do think that there's an agenda that is also being exploited by that side, which is trying to harness, and they're going to use it for something. And it's just going to, once again, I always go back to the consolidation of power in the hands of fewer and fewer people. And that's the most objective way I can paint it, the most inoffensive way that I can paint it. If people want to play right versus left, woke versus anti-woke, and that sort of tribalistic stuff, I don't really engage in that, because for me, I try to zoom out a little bit more and I see how both sides are being played. And they are, you know, like, I'm not going to drift off into this territory, but yeah, we got to be very careful that we don't find ourselves in a, like, how do you stay outside of that dialectic where you can, because it's very easy to get sucked into it on either side, because what usually happens is one side overshoots and make these outrageous propositions, and the other side will do it for spite. Like, for example, the cancellation of Jimmy Kimmel. Never really understood why the guy was popular in the first place. I didn't like his views about COVID. Sort of, you know, obviously promoting the script. But at the same time, you know, I got to ask myself, like, is cheering on the cancellation, is that a good thing? You know, isn't it kind of interesting and ironic that we're now cheering on the cancellation of those people when we should be saying, okay, you know, you said something which many people found offensive, but at the same time, is it enough to justify your cancel? Like, so my concern is that now we're seeing the same, we're going to see the same thing, but from the opposite point of view. And so it's just going to keep escalating, unfortunately, because, yeah, you know, we're not going to be the bigger people and realize, okay, yeah, you know, okay, we rattled your cage a bit, but you're not canceled. Just, you know, use some common sense next time before you speak type thing, as opposed to, ha, you did it to us, so now we're going to do it to you, and we're going to do it even worse, which is only going to escalate the problem even more. Just yeah, like the, you know, the, what was the other thing that happened recently? There was that, and then there was, oh yeah, the designation of Antifa as a terrorist organization is also a slippery slope, because that could potentially be weaponized. It's always been one of the cardinal truths of, like, the libertarians, that they're going to use threats of homegrown terrorism to suppress civil liberties. They've always done that.
Yeah.
So I think that ultimately will be the end result. So while there's some good to it in that, yeah, there's a lot of very deranged, psychotic, mentally unhealthy people that have been spawned from this distorted system, you know, just be careful, because it's a very slippery slope, and eventually the tables will turn and those guns will turn on you.
Well said. I couldn't agree more. Listen, if Sinclair says we don't like Jimmy Kimmel, his numbers sucked and he was unfunny, terminally yeah, unfunny, which I think he was, but that's me.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
that's fine. But when Pam,
Jay Leno on steroids.
Yeah, when Pam Bondi comes out and says, "Oh, we're going to have to start doing hate speech," like, no, I don't need the government yeah, defining hate speech, malinformation, disinformation, none of it. Yes. Right. When the FCC comes out and says, "Well, we're frowning on what Jimmy said," that's wrong. That's free speech. Free speech is the government impinging on what you can and can't say. Now, that's different from consequences of free speech. I could be, you know, when I put my words out into the world, I'm responsible for whatever comes back at me from that, good or bad. That's totally fine. I'm fine with that. I'm totally okay. Like, if somebody who's working for me, Nate, really goes off the ranch and says something that I feel is against my brand or my morality, they're fired, right? End of story. That's okay. Mm-hmm. That's not what we're talking about here. But that was disturbing to me to see the government leaning in on that stuff there, because they have no right. No, ever on that stuff.
Yeah.
But you saw like
it's an age-old debate. Yeah.
Yeah. No, because it'll turn around. And just because it's our side or the other side doing it, I hate it, I love it, doesn't make a bit of difference to me. I'm a free speech absolutist when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah. Like, I think Charlie Kirk, if he had a lot of those conversations with people one-on-one, you know, the outcome would have been so much, so different. You know, just because it's a spectacle, it's always, there's always contention, and it's unfortunate that it has to be that way, but it's human nature. So we can be idealists, but we also have to prepare for the reality that people aren't going to get along, and there's going to be, you know, there's going to be conflict on every dimension. So that's why we prep.
We have to be aware that some people, they don't have a deep buffer of resilience. They go straight from, I'm a little bit annoyed, to violence. If we wanted to declare Antifa a criminal organization, I could make a case for that. I don't like terrorism because terrorism is a noun, and you'll never defeat a noun, and it's vague, and it comes to me post-Patriot Act, which I'm a hater of Patriot Act because I know 9/11 was a scam.
That's a good way of putting it. It's a noun, yeah. Never thought about it like that. Crime is a verb.
Yeah, you can fight a war against a noun forever. You'll never defeat it.
I'm going to have to use that. I'm going to have to quote
Excellent.
You.
Feel free. All right, well, we've been talking with Nate of Canadian Prepper. Here's the webpage for his YouTube channel. Awesome channel there, the Canadian Prepper. Very easy to find if you can spell Canadian and Prepper. 1.34 million subscribers, closing in on 3,000 videos at this point in time, covering all kinds of stuff, and really great thing. By the way, I love your half-acre food fort here. That thing is amazing.
Yeah, it's a work in progress, man, but thanks, you know. I know you've uploaded a few videos of the homestead. Is that something you're trying to do more of?
I'm going to do more of that, yeah. So one of the more popular things was Evie gave a presentation at our summit, and it was just, here's all the things we failed at. And people love that, you know. So we've had a lot of failure along the way. That's farming, at least the way we do it.
Good stuff.
Any other place people can follow you?
Yeah, I mean, just Canadian Prepper YouTube channel. I also have the Prepper News channel where I talk about current events every day and, you know, share my thoughts and speculations about the state of things. It seems to be more popular. I would encourage people to go to Canadian Prepper where you actually get, you know, practical advice. And we interview most of the guests on the Prepper News channel now, which a lot of people enjoy.
All right, well. Canadian Prepper. Nate, thank you so much for your time today. Let's do it again.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.